Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi. Today on The Wildlife, I'll be joined by Christian Teleki, Vice President for Science Initiatives for SeaWeb and former Director of the International Coral Reef Action Network. We'll talk about the biology of corals, threats to coral reefs, and what can be done to halt their decline. But first, let me play you today's creature call. This week's creature call is from a large semi-aquatic herbivorous mammal from sub-Saharan Africa. Now, listen carefully and see if you can guess today's creature call. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again, tell you what kind of animal made them, and also give you a preview of next week's creature call. Now, let me turn to my conversation with Christian Teleki. Christian Teleki joined SeaWeb as Vice President for Science Initiatives in November 2009. For the decade before that, he served as the Director of the International Coral Reef Action Network, a unique global partnership dedicated to addressing the serious decline in the health of the world's coral reefs. During his tenure there, Christian had oversight for more than 40 coral reef projects in 35 countries. Project activities range from livelihood diversification and resource management to the prevention and mitigation of ecological degradation of coral reefs through management, monitoring, and public awareness actions. In addition to his duties with the International Coral Reef Action Network, Christian established and led the One Ocean Program at the United Nations Environment Program's World Conservation Monitoring Center, designed to reflect the interconnected nature of the world's seas and its coastlines, the rich and varied biodiversity they support, and human reliance on its resources and services. Christian Teleki has a diverse background in marine science and conservation, and his field experience extends from the polar to tropical environments. He is particularly interested in the relationship that humans have with the ocean and promoting the sustainable use of its resources. He has degrees from the University of California, Santa Barbara, and Cambridge University. He also is on the editorial board of Aquatic Conservation, is a member of the Resource Users Group for the European Project on Ocean Acidification, and is a steering committee member of the Global Islands Partnership and the Global Forum on Oceans, Coasts, and Islands. When we spoke recently, I asked Christian what first got him interested in coral reefs.
Well, you know, it actually goes back quite a ways. In 1974, my parents took us all down. In fact, my grandparents took us all down to the Bay Islands in Honduras. And I was a young boy at the time, and never having seen a coral reef before, and parents giving me a mask and looking underwater, I just couldn't believe the life that was under there. These, you know, coming from Canada, where most of the lakes are pretty murky, and not being able to see anything, to warm waters of the Caribbean, beautiful fish, wonderful creatures all around, and I think from that point on, I just was fascinated by this ecosystem that I just couldn't believe something like that could exist. And you know, as I got older, I you know, made sure that we went back and forth to see coral reefs, and I think it was just after I left high school that I realized that for me, this is exactly what I wanted to do. I spent another semester down in the Virgin Islands before I started university, and I just fell in love. I wanted to do something about these reefs. And at the time, there were already some significant changes that were going on in the Caribbean. And I felt like, you know, something needed to be done about it, and decided to sort of commit my, you know, the last 25, 30 years to doing something about it.
So what kind of changes were you seeing just in your travels there?
So to give you a good example, in the Caribbean, up until the, I guess it was the early 1980s, the dominant herbivore, you know, the plant-eating animal, was the long black-spined sea urchin. And anyone who's been has memory of the Caribbean will know what a sea urchin is looks like. You know, these long black spines, and you know, these things would, you know, were covering the, you know, areas of the reef, and they were keeping the plants and algae at bay over the reefs, and they were the dominant herbivore. And in the early, just after about 1982, 83, there was a disease that went through that everyone thinks was introduced through the Panama Canal that went through and wiped out nearly the entire population of the black-spined and long-spined sea urchin in the Caribbean. And so suddenly there was an unknown reason, but this caused a major shift in the ecosystem and the balance of the ecosystem. And so even just seeing that change, and whether that was, likely introduced by a human contaminant from bilge of a boat into the Panama Canal, no one's really certain. But it was sort of like the start of a downward trend. So if you think about it in a place like Jamaica, where, at one stage there was 80% coverage of coral coverage, in a matter of years that went from the, over I guess about a 10-year period, it went from having all the sea urchins dying off to a couple of big hurricane events to the overfishing of the other dominant herbivore, the parrotfish. You suddenly had a major switch from lots of luxurious, beautiful coral reefs to 80% algae and 20% coral cover. And wow. So this was a major change, and really got people thinking about how we can have an effect on the ecosystem and this sequence of events that occurred in the Caribbean. And there are some positive stories. I don't want to paint a negative picture, but certainly it got a lot of coral reef scientists really worried about what they call a phase shift. And what I mean by that is just a complete sort of flip of the ecosystem away from being a coral dominated to an algae dominated. And algae grows much faster than coral reefs. I mean, if you think about, your average coral reef probably grows about the rate at which your fingernails grow. In some places, slower, a little bit faster. But, so if you think about that, they're not growing fast. And plants obviously grow faster, and they can outcompete the coral. So if you're changing the system in any way, if you're adding pollutants or it gives competitive advantage to other, organisms that grow out these corals.
So tell me a little bit about corals. A lot of people think corals are plants, but they're invertebrates. So can you tell me more about them?
And sure, yeah. I mean, coral reefs are really interesting. I mean, there are a lot of languages in the world that don't have a word for coral reefs.
Oh, really?
because you can't, is it a living rock? Is it a plant? Is it a rock? Is it an animal? And so it's often very difficult to describe another language, but basically what, a coral is what we would call a symbiotic organism. And what I mean by that is that it is an animal, a colonial animal, so it has lots of individuals that come together to form an animal, but within the tissue of this animal live tiny little plants called zooxanthellae. And these tiny little plants are you'll see that whenever anyone sticks their head underwater and sees the color and of the coral reefs, it's the pigment and the coloration within these little tiny algae, the zooxanthellae, that live within the tissues that give it its vibrant color. And so this algae then plays a really important role in taking up carbon and allowing that carbon to be taken into this animal, so that it then can secrete this calcium carbonate structure. So it gives us the hard skeleton. And so photosynthesizing of the algae, and providing nutrients to the carbon to the coral to then allow it to grow. The corals also then have these, these polyps that have tiny little tentacles that then can also take plankton and feed from plankton out of the water column itself. And so if you get all of these in a particular species of coral, you get all these polyps growing together in different shapes and different sizes, they then just start, to form a coral, an individual coral. And when you add all these bits, all these different corals together, you get what we would call a coral reef. And it's this three-dimensional structure that's really lots of cracks and crevices that provides all this amazing habitat for all the fish and animals. And in fact, coral reefs contain, I think the estimate's about 25% of all marine species live in and around coral reefs.
25%?
Yeah, 25%. Yeah, wow. So that's all the mollusks, the echinoderms and sponges, or the clams, the oysters, the starfish, all these sorts of things. And that's a rough estimate. So you can see that there's these are important organisms. And if you think about the total surface area, and there's lots of debate among scientists, where does a coral reef begin and a coral reef end? But if you take a rough estimate, coral reefs occupy less than 1% of the world's ocean surface. So, and that I think people equate to about roughly half the area of France. And so, here's an ecosystem that covers a small part of the world, but plays an incredible, as a sort of mega diverse ecosystem, and provides an amazing amount of what we would call ecosystem services or value to human beings, whether it's protecting the shoreline or fish or tourism. So when we impact them in some way, they obviously are taking things away from the diversity, but also the people's livelihoods. And I was just gonna say, the one thing I want to say was about, just to go back to your point about what is a coral reef. I think what's interesting about them is how they grow. Is that they grow much like a tree grows, putting down a layer by layer by layer. And so what some climate scientists have done is they've taken cores out of coral reefs, because some of these things can live hundreds of years long, and they can look at those growth rings and determine properties of the sea that then can be extracted to tell information about the climate.
Oh, really?
And yes. So it's a fascinating science about looking at these cores and looking at different sea level heights, different sea temperatures has implications on the coral growth, and that gives you indications of what the climate is like.
Wow. Well, there's so much to talk about. I want to get back to the idea of the ecosystem services and
sure.
talk a little bit about how these coral reefs protect the shoreline, and you talked a little bit already about providing habitat, but
yeah. So if you think about, everyone will have seen a coral reef, this where the waves are breaking over the over the reef, and these are usually, they're different types of reef, but they're what we'll call a fringing reef, which is just offshore, is because of the structure of the reefs, they have these stony construction. It's like a pier almost, or if you had piles of rocks, that if a wave comes crashing into it, the wave, the energy is absorbed by the reef itself, and so that there's very little amount of energy that then is transferred beyond the reef. So you often have, when you look at lagoons behind the reefs, often you'll see in places that with tourism destinations where boats will anchor behind the reef, because the majority of the energy of waves coming in is being absorbed, and so it's calmer water that's behind the reef.
Which
and
I
so,
always appreciate because
yeah,
I
no,
get
exactly.
seasick,
so,
you know.
Exactly. Yeah. So when you think about, if you had it's not gonna protect something from a tsunami. That is a serious amount of a water and energy that's coming through that's going to overwhelm anything, as we know from recent experience of shoreline structures. But if you think about storm waves and storm surge, that's going to protect the shoreline. And if you think about what generally is on the shoreline, well, often it's communities. There's a significant amount of the world's population that lives within 60 kilometers of the shoreline. So it stops the coastal erosion. And it's protecting, provides an integral role. And so a healthy reef is growing, is alive, can absorb the energy. But a reef that's dying, well, it starts to erode. And it gets, it becomes more fragile. And if it breaks down, it won't stop the energy of the waves coming to hit the shoreline.
So it becomes more fragile and will start breaking off. And
exactly, yeah. So if the coral is dying. So a place like the Maldives, for example, well, the place like the Maldives is just in the Central Indian Ocean, is very are very low-lying islands that depend highly on the coral reefs to absorb the waves, the waves that are coming in. Now, the problem that the Maldives face, of course, is sea level rise, and they're already very concerned about, you know, being inundated with water. In fact, there are places in the Pacific that no longer are the coral reefs able to grow with the sea level rise, that the rate the sea level rise is happening. And you see regular pictures of places in the Pacific, for example, of a high of a spring tide where people barbecuing in knee deep in water. And that is a regular occurrence in a number of these areas.
Wow. So how many different species are there? And, you know, how do they grow? Where do they grow? Do different corals require different habitats, like certain salinity or temperature requirements?
Yeah. I mean, in generally speaking, coral reefs, you probably could use the majority of them lie within the Tropic of Cancer and Tropic of Capricorn, really. There are other areas, you know, where they lie outside of it due to particular oceanographic conditions. Coral reefs like warm, clear water because they obviously the algae that lives in their tissue needs to, you know, photosynthesize. So the sunlight is obviously, you know, very important. And they, you know, they like, and these conditions are quite narrow. And so if you change these conditions in any way, then it stresses the coral reefs out. So for example, in many parts of the world over the last couple of decades, we've seen a phenomenon called coral bleaching. And do you remember how I talked earlier about this algae that lives within the tissue? Well, as a stress reaction to these higher temperatures, the algae leaves the tissue of the corals, causing them to have a what we would call a bleached appearance. And this bleached appearance is this response to stress. And so these narrow conditions, so they're a very good indicator if there's some changes going on in the environment. Now, people often call coral reefs the canary in the coal mine because the sensitivity that they have to changes in their environment.
So if the algae leaves the tissue, you know, and you get this coral bleaching, is there a way for the coral to, you know, feed, well, get its nutrients?
They get some nutrients, and there are places in the world where bleaching is a regular event. In Thailand, bleaching seems to be a regular event. Corals do have the ability to recover. They have the ability to get some nutrients, but it's not optimal for them. And in 1998, a very good example, there was a mass bleaching event globally, but particularly affected the Indian Ocean, where in some places there was up to 90% of corals died. And
90%. Wow.
90%. There were some, and so obviously, you know, this is what really put climate change and, you know, the impacts of climate change on coral reefs on the map. No one ever thought that they would see such a mass event. And there's a great story that I remember. I was going out to the Seychelles at the time, and we arrived there at the peak bleaching event. And I remember hearing some anecdotes from some of the dive operators there that said, "This is fantastic. Look how clean and white the corals look. It's not dirty. It's just pure as snow." And, you know, sure enough, this particular event lasted so long that it caused a lot of these corals that had bleached to die. And, you know, and suddenly they realized that, wait a second, this is not as good as we thought. And it sort of caused them to learn a lot more about coral reefs, climate change, the impacts that climate change can have on the coral reefs. And so I think it was just a really interesting example of suddenly, you know, a wide swath of society around the world taking an interest in you know, in the impacts that global events can have on coral reefs.
Now, there are over 1,400 species of shallow water stony corals. Is that right?
That's
right.
There
are a lot of different kinds of corals. Could you describe some?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there are, you know, corals are really, I mean, they're interesting in that the same species of coral that may have a boulder type shape near the surface in, you know, between let's say 30 meters depth or about 100 feet, they at deeper depths, they might be sort of plate-like, because what they're doing is that they're adapting to their light conditions. Because if you imagine a boulder and the sun's shining down, well, only parts of those sides are going to get the, you know, the light. But if you flattened out at deeper waters, you then can maximize the small amount of light that's coming down to those depths. But corals themselves have come in a range of different shapes. You have what are called branching corals. You have so the plate-like corals. You have lettuce leaf corals. You have corals that look like clubbed fingers. You have corals sort of have a mushroom shape, and all of these different corals, obviously make up an entire reef itself.
And do you find different types of corals in different either types of conditions or in different geographic locations?
Well, to give you a sort of a sense of what we're talking about in terms of diversity, the Caribbean has coral reefs in it, but there are probably about 60 to 70 species, depending on where you make the cut of corals in the Caribbean. Now, the center of coral biodiversity is in the Indo-Pacific, or the coral triangle, which is, if you think about an area that's sort of Indonesia, the Philippines, Malaysia, in that area, Southeast Asia, that is the heart of coral reef diversity. And they're looking at there of over 600 species of corals in that area alone.
Really? So
yeah.
A huge difference. What about like Hawaii?
So Hawaii is, Hawaii is, and it really is, has a lot of, quite a few species of corals, but it has a lot of what we would call endemic corals. So corals that are unique to Hawaii alone because of its geographic location and isolation there in the Central Pacific.
And then, do people harvest corals?
They do. I mean, there's a huge industry for harvesting corals in the aquarium trade, for example, and getting the coral reefs to put inside the aquarium tank. So people, so there's a big aquarium trade because people want to have live corals in their tanks. And so this is I'll come back to that point because there's something that's quite an important point to make about that. So you have the harvesting of corals. That in some countries they harvest the corals. They do coral mining for the limestone, and limestone is then made into cement. And what I'll do is I'll just tell you some stories about some of these things as I go along, because I think these are quite some interesting examples. I was once involved in a project in central Vietnam, and it was about raising awareness amongst some communities and fishing communities. And what was fantastic was that there was a local cement company that was mining the reef. And once some of the local fishermen started making the connections between the reef and the fisheries and supporting the local livelihoods and the importance of the reefs for the reproduction of fish and fish abundance, they took it upon themselves as an act of civil disobedience to lie in front of the cement trucks to stop them from going to mine the corals.
Really?
And I thought it was just, it was extreme, but they made a point and they stopped the cement company from mining the reef. And I thought it was just that little bit of making that connection between, the reef and the abundance and livelihoods that they thought, well, hang on a second, this is, we're losing something here and we need to do something about it. There are other parts of the world where, in small amounts where coral is used to be ground up, and it's used as lime to activate the betel nut. So there are some cultures where betel nut is chewed, and they need a bit of the lime to activate the betel nut that's in the that they chew. So that's
what do you mean activate it?
What it does is it provides the I haven't done it myself, but it's a way of just getting the the active properties out of betel nut into into the body, as it were.
And so is it like alcohol, or have that kind of effect, or is it medicinal?
The betel nut is chewed in many areas around the world, and it's kind of a gives you a bit of a euphoric feeling, a bit of a pick me up, as it were. Mm-hmm. But a lot of cultures use that. But that's a
like caffeine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a minor that's a minor area. The other, in terms of coral reefs and the actually extracting and harvesting coral reefs, there's also been the harvesting of coral reefs for the precious jewelry trade. And at the moment, there are some species of and these are deeper water corals, and when we talk about some of these deep water corals, we're talking hundreds of feet in depth, that that are being made and polished into jewelry. And a particular family of corals, the red and pink corals, we estimate between 30 to 50 tons are being extracted out of the sea per year. And that's a lot. That's a lot of material that's being extracted, and particularly in the deep. When you asked me earlier about where are corals found, so I talked about the shallow water corals and these tropical corals in the warmer waters, but you also have these other individual corals that don't necessarily form these coral reefs as we know them in deep waters, and those are spread throughout the world, and that's the ecosystem we know very little about. You have the fishing trawling boats, and if you think about a plow, or of a farmer tilling its field, and the effect that has when you draw that across a field, it basically lifts up, moves, takes out, removes any plant that's there. So if you think about a trawling boat that's dragging its net across the bottom, it's basically scooping up everything and removing that layer of any kind of biodiversity that's there. And so that's happening around the world, and we're just starting to learn about this really unique deep water coral ecosystem, and find out where it is and the importance that it plays. And likewise with these precious corals, the red and pink and the black corals, we know a little bit about their importance in the ecosystem, but we don't know enough to be able to say that this is that it can sustainably manage to have 30 to 50 tons taken from the sea. And if you think about that further, it just underpins you that more, that we know more about outer space than we do our own ocean.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, I've heard a statistic that reefs are degrading faster than data can be collected, and less than 10% of an estimated 1 to 2 million reef species have been identified.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's true. I mean, I think that I've heard that statistic for a long time, and we're just getting to know this the reef, and even further with the latest scientific techniques of and genetic analysis, you then realize that what was once thought to be a single species, for example, of algae that lived in the tissue of coral reefs, it turns out there may be more that have predisposition to different climatic conditions, which would then start to explain, for example, in the Persian Gulf, why you have corals that can withstand the extreme temperatures that occur there in the summer, yet are managing to come back and survive, albeit there are other pressures that are going on. And that's raised lots of interesting questions about amongst the scientific community, if there are this diversity that occurs, are there particular areas that we should focus on in terms of conservation effort that may be able to withstand changes in sea surface temperature and temperatures of the ocean in the future? So that's just a small example of if you just start to look very closely. But there are other sorts of things that live within the crevices and cracks of coral reefs. And I remember a colleague did some really interesting work where he took an endoscope, that you would normally use on human beings, and that goes down into one's esophagus and has a good look around the intestine. They took that same camera and started pushing it into, you know, into the cracks and crevices of the reef, and found a, you know, all range of different community and interesting organisms and what, you know, things that, that people had not seen before, because they, you know, it's difficult obviously to access that that environment. So there is definitely a lot more to be learned and discovered on coral reefs, without a doubt.
And I've also understood that some very important drugs have been developed from the chemicals found in the coral reef organisms, like AZT to treat HIV infections.
Sure. I mean, the pharmaceutical properties have, you know, are limitless. I know that there was a sponge that was found that had significant anti-cancer agent to it.
Really?
Yeah. So that, you know, there are, I mean, it's, I think one has to be really careful about the pharmaceutical argument, in that, you know, there is bioprospecting going on around the world. I mean, and bioprospecting is not unlike what, you know, a miner, you know, sitting in the stream, sifting through the samples of rocks to look for that little gold nugget. Well, if you think about that in a marine context, you have, you know, institutions, organizations, individuals, you know, sifting through all these, you know, samples, looking for that unique property, looking for that little gold nugget. And, you know, so it's a complicated business. It's nothing that's going to happen overnight. But like the rainforest that holds all sorts of interesting properties and medicinal value, you know, we need to make sure that we're not, you know, undermining this by destroying the marine environment, because it you know, it may one day have that property or that particular pharmaceutical component that's going to be life-saving for a sector of the population.
What are all the threats to coral reefs? I mean, we talked a little bit about, you know, them having such a narrow band for survival.
Yeah.
So global warming, I would assume, would be a huge threats because they're so sensitive to changes in water temperature.
Exactly. Yeah, again, as up until about, I guess it was 10, 15, maybe 20 years ago, you know, the big things that were, you know, that were impacting coral reefs were, you know, more or less localized. I mean, you had, you know, pollution, whether that was, you know, sedimentation from, you know, on changing the landscape, so that if there was agriculture going on in a river, in a watershed up river, all that stuff was then washing down in the river and into the sea and having an impact on, you know, on the reefs by smothering them, making it too murky for them to photosynthesize and to live. There's also been overfishing by and destructive fishing practices, where you're removing some of the key species. And in some areas, dynamite fishing is you know, still going on.
Can you describe that?
Sure. Dynamite fishing is a very destructive, easy way to fish. And what one does is, in many countries, they take some locally acquired chemicals, fertilizers, put them into a plastic bottle with a fuse, light the fuse, throw it over the boat, and it goes in the water, explodes, and it kills the fish, and all the fish float to the surface, and the fish are collected, and then you know, it's an easy way to, you know, to fish. Of course, however, what happens if you look at some of the blast areas is it just decimates the coral as well. And so not only are you killing the corals and or the fish, removing the fish and all the other organisms that are there, but you're also killing the corals. And so you have sort of reduced this three-dimensional sort of house-like structure, you know, to use an analogy, and have it flattened like a, you know, not unlike what a, you know, happens with a, you know, a tornado comes through and you know, mows down a house. And the other, of course, practice fishing for the aquarium trade is cyanide fishing. And cyanide is used to be injected into reef crevices, that it stuns the fish. The fish are then collected, popped into bags, and they're used for the, you know, the aquarium trade. And that we hope that it's a practice that is not as prevalent as it used to be, but that's certainly another, you know, cyanide and coral reefs, you know, don't mix. there it's particularly lethal for coral reefs.
Are there other threats?
In terms of some other impacts, one would want to look at, if you look at natural impacts, hurricanes, big storms can have impact. Those obviously we have little control over. Increasing of diseases, we're starting to see in coral diseases around the world, and there's a question of whether that's come from land being put into the some sort of pathogen, some sort of disease being coming from the land that's made its way into the marine system. But I think a lot of it is around, if you think about, if you stress an animal, if you stress it enough, its immunity is going to be reduced and it's going to be more vulnerable to diseases. And so I think that maybe is the same thing that's happening with coral reefs, that they're so stressed is that they just can't recover. Their resiliency is not what it used to be.
And so tell me about recovery of coral reefs. How long does it take to grow? I mean, some of them are very, or are all of them very slow growing species.
Yeah. I mean, they're slow growing. There's some really, relatively fast growing species that can colonize quite quickly. I mean, there are lots of, it depends, it depends on, if there is suitable bottom for the coral larva to settle on and grow. It depends on the right sort of conditions. If you've reduced the pollution, the other sort of stressors, the disturbances that are in the environment. So corals, corals have been around for millions of years, in one shape or form or another. And they've gone through, major environmental stresses in those time periods. So changes in sea level rise, changes in salinity, changes in global temperature. But of course, the big $65,000 question is whether corals can recover and adapt at the rate at which we're changing the environment. So that is the question, we just can't answer at the moment. So some corals have been found to recover quite quickly in areas if you've reduced the pressures that are on them. Others just don't come back because there are pollutants or there's some other stresses in the waters that precludes them from any kind of recovery. So what we're trying to do, obviously, in the scientific conservation world, is to try to reduce those stressors, get people more educated about what is it that makes coral reefs grow and thrive, and their importance, and how you can stop it having impact on your activities and things you do. And there are a number of people that are out there that are saying, well, we should have artificial reefs. Let's put out some artificial reefs. And, that's fine for a tourist attraction to try to get people to understand more about coral reefs and get, fish to come and gather around. But it doesn't solve the large scale, coral health issue in it. And really it's about, trying to change behaviors and trying to change those, reduce those inputs that are coming into the sea, because corals will recover given the right sort of conditions.
So what, I was going to ask this at the end, but what can people do, or the top 10 list?
There are a lot, obviously, and I think there are a couple. On one hand, if you're Let's look at it. I'll look at it one from the tourist perspective, and then look at it from the sort of the local community and a maybe developing country perspective. The tourist perspective: someone who interacts with, who may go on holiday, is to be informed. Learn about this really unique ecosystem, and it's not a rocket science to know, once you start to learn a little bit more about it, that you don't want to, if you go on holiday, you don't want to stand on it. You don't want to collect it. If you don't want to buy any materials that are coming from from the coral reef to support an activity that might have an impact on the reef. Thinking about the sort of the fish that you buy, which should you know, should be come from a sustainable source, and often can have an impact on the reef. There's a responsible snorkeling behavior. There's responsible scuba behavior. And so it's and asking the right sort of questions when if you go on holiday, as a tourist. I think there are probably some other things, we could do as a global community about climate change. And that's something that, it's just, reduce our carbon emissions. And, I think as conservationists, as environmentalists, as scientists who are concerned about the world, I think we'd wish that for all of the ecosystems that are and animals that are out there without a doubt. And that would be our big wish.
Are there, for tourists, is there some website or particular documents or groups that you would recommend that they check out to learn more, to be able to learn more about what to do or where, how to act more responsibly?
There are a number of different organizations. I used to work with a group called the Coral Reef Alliance, who are based in San Francisco, and we did a number of information documents to that effect around responsible behavior and around coral reefs and scuba diving and whale watching and turtle watching and all these things, and you probably can still download those from their website. It's available in a number of different languages, and they're just sort of easy sort of understanding do's and don'ts of around being and interacting around coral reefs.
And then, legally, how are corals protected or not protected?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. I mean, it obviously varies from country to country in terms of their national legislation and coral reef policy. And so, obviously, there are marine protected areas are obviously a very good mechanism for protecting. For protecting coral reefs. An example of the United States would be, the Florida Keys Marine Sanctuary has been very effective at making sure that, the Florida reefs are doing better than they were, 20 years ago. There are international mechanisms that some are not legally binding, but something called the International Coral Reef Initiative. And that is an initiative that's where governments and NGOs come together on a regular basis to talk about what are the most important coral reef issues, what are the things that we should be thinking about as governments, and are there some particular issues that we should be tackling? And while it's not legally binding, it certainly has informed processes like the U.S. government funding the coral reef crime scene investigation work that looks at helping people collect the evidence when there's been some sort of damage or impact to a coral reef that's going to stand up in a court of law, and making them more effective at collecting this information and enforcing these regulations. There are other mechanisms like the Convention on the International Trade for Endangered Species, CITES, and CITES, almost the majority of coral reefs, with the exception of a small handful, are listed on the CITES convention. So there is and there are different levels within this convention, but the stony corals are the ones that we see on coral reefs that we've been talking about.
Okay.
They're on what's called Appendix 2. And I don't want to get into I won't get into the jargon of it, but basically what this does, it provides a regulatory mechanism for the trade of coral reefs. So there, if you want to export or import coral, it has to have the hard coral. It has to have a CITES permit. It tells you where it came from, how it was collected. Gives it some of the provenance of the coral, so that it just can't. So there's an assurance that it's not just being hacked off the reef and being exported. So there's more of a regulatory mechanism and control of the trade. And I think the most important bit about it is not to ban the trade, but what it tries to do is it tries to stomp out the illegal, the incredible legal trade, but also to get a handle of what's the ebb and flow of this material that better informs, you know, national and regional legislation and conservation approaches to, you know, to coral reefs.
Now, at the most recent CITES meeting in March 2010 at the Conference of Parties, there was a proposal to list red and pink coral under Appendix 2. Can you tell me about why that was necessary and what that proposal was?
Well, the feeling was that I mean, we were CWEB was heavily involved in facilitating and convening both conservation industry and governments around and raising the importance of the red and pink corals. And they belong to a family called Coralidae, and these corals are highly valued for their extracted from the sea, they're polished and made into jewelry, and there is a long history of this artisanal craft in a number of countries around the world. But in the recent period, over the last 10 years or so, there has been a marked decline in some areas of the size of these colonies that are being extracted from the sea. And you know, so at one stage maybe they were 50 centimeters high, and now they're on average 3 to 5 centimeters high in the Mediterranean.
What? 50 centimeters?
Yeah. So at one stage, and now they're, the average colony that's being extracted from the Mediterranean is 3 to 5 centimeters. Now, you know, it's easy to see that there is obviously something going on. And if you're thinking that the artisanal trade in the Mediterranean is having to import from the Pacific, and the, you know, total global extraction is 30 to 50 tons of this material, you know, there's obviously, you know, something going on. And there was a feeling that, well, let's not ban the trade, but let's get a better handle on it so we can be more responsible about putting some sustainability into it. And so CWEB worked with, you know, the jewelry industry and to get them sort of thinking about, well, maybe we shouldn't do this. In fact, there are other ways that we can derive inspiration around our jewelry to create these interesting pieces of jewelry, but not use the raw material itself. And there are obviously sections of industry that were vehemently against it, to the extent of which they, you know, we're almost misinforming some of the people whose livelihoods were involved, or that are involved with the red coral trade and jewelry business, and you know, their concern was, well, I want my nephew, I want my grandchildren to continue in this trade that's been in my family for hundreds of years, and I absolutely agree with that, and that should be the case, but at the rate it's being extracted, that's not going to happen, and so. So we're not talking about banning the trade. We're trying to get, you know, the idea with using CITES as a mechanism was, let's regulate it. Let's get a better handle of what's going on and where it's coming from, so that the better management measures can be put into place to really truly make it sustainable over a long period of time.
And so what happened with that proposal? It did not pass.
Yes, it didn't. And, you know, without wanting to make this too, too political, it certainly became a very politically charged issue. And I think largely it was just the lobbying efforts of a country that felt very strongly about it, that didn't need to be managed, and that it was being managed fine at the national level, and convinced a number of other countries to support their position. And it was just very unfortunate, because it was largely based around misinformation that they were disseminating, and that by implementing this, that this was going to have some major effect on livelihoods, local livelihoods in developing countries. Which, if you think about it, what we're talking more about is, well, let's find out what the trade is and maybe have some more equity in the trade, because if let's say a kilo or 2.5 pounds of of the red and pink coral goes for maybe $1,500. If you then start taking the polished jewelry, you know, just small pieces of this, some of these necklaces are fetching prices up to $25,000. So there is a you know, there's if the industry is making the $25,000 and the actual local community or local fish, the person who's harvesting the coral is making $1,500 for a kilo, you know, I think it's difficult to argue that livelihoods will be impacted, you know, because we're talking about trying to balance it out across the board. And so it was just very unfortunate that it was being treated as a fishery. These are not fish. These are not mobile organisms. They are in one location. And so there was lots of confusion there about how one might apply CITES to it. But it was clear if you looked at the particular sort of rules on how things can be listed within the convention.
Yeah, it was a bad year for protection of a lot of marine species.
The marine species really did not fare well. In fact, we started calling it, instead of Doha, we were calling it Noha, because of the it was, and I think it's really got. I think the conservation community is now sort of retreating and rethinking about how. What can be done to really make CITES effective for marine species? It really is set us back considerably, and we just can't go on and continue at the rate at which we're extracting bluefin tuna, sharks. I mean, more than 75 million sharks a year are being taken from the seas. I mean, 75 million. I mean, at the moment there are no mechanisms to protect them. And so we're really essentially shooting ourselves in the foot for any kind of future sustainability or future diversity within the marine environment.
And what makes protecting these marine species so difficult?
You know, I think there are a couple things. You know, one is, you know, if you go to the a majority of the countries around the world, although it has a coastline, I bet you'd find the majority of the populace and actually never put their head underwater. You know, so if you think about, I often use this when I do talks to groups, is I show a picture of some deforestation of a rainforest, and I say, what's going on in here? And they say, yeah, everyone, all hands go up and say, yeah, that's deforestation. I then show them a beautiful picture of the sea, looking out at the sea, and I say, what's going on out here? And a couple of hands go up, maybe overfishing. Yeah, but say, how do you know? And they, of course, is that that it's sort of, it's an out of sight, out of mind that we're still, it's this myth, these myths that still are pervasive. And I think it is changing, but it's still pervasive through society that the sea is bountiful and limitless, that it's going to absorb all the things that we can put towards it, and it just is not. We know the statistics are there. The science is there, showing that there are some fundamental changes in the environment. And I think it's difficult conceptually. It's difficult for a lot of people and policymakers to get their head around this three-dimensional and watery environment that they can't see what's happening below the waterline. And I think that just makes it, really difficult for them to connect with. I think people are starting to connect more with the seas through a lot of the issues around sustainable fish work, and certainly CWEB has been working with a number of different organizations and industry to improve their practices and make seafood more sustainable and raising the awareness with the general public, because once the public has a raised awareness, then they can start asking hard questions to the people that they elect about, why is there more protection? Why are there no more fish in the sea? What should we be doing? What are you doing about it? What's the government doing about it? And pressing that. And until that time, until people start really, and thinking about the importance that the oceans play, it's going to be a very uphill battle.
Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me today.
It's been an absolute pleasure, and I want to paint, such a gloomy picture. I mean, I think there is a lot of hope. There are a lot of small success stories that are out there as far as people coming together to do something about it, to make the environment, the marine environment, a better place and concern. And I think there is some increasing concern, about it. But let's not wait until it's a real problem affecting everybody. I think we can do something about it now.
Well, thank you very much. This has been wonderful.
Pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed those insights into corals and coral reefs with Christian Teleki, Vice President for Science Initiatives for CWEB and former Director of the International Coral Reef Action Network. Now, let me play you today's creature call once again and see if you've guessed it correctly. This week's creature call is the sound from a large semi-aquatic herbivorous mammal from sub-Saharan Africa. It's also the third largest land animal after the elephant and the white rhinoceros. Have a guess yet? Here's the sound from a hippopotamus. For next week's creature call, I'll play the sound from a type of pinniped that you can often see showing off its natural behaviors in shows at zoos, aquariums, and circuses. They make all sorts of strange sounds, from barks to honks to trumpets and roars. In fact, a baby or pup can pick out its mother from among hundreds just from her sound. Here's your preview. Be sure to tune in next week when I'll replay this strange sound from the wild world and reveal the animal that made it. Next week, I'll also talk with Rhett Butler, a writer and conservationist who founded MongaBay.com, a top environmental website that seeks to raise interest in and appreciation of wild lands and wildlife, while examining the impact of emerging trends in climate, technology, economics, and finance on conservation and development. We'll talk about what prompted him to develop this site and also some of the most interesting and bizarre wildlife stories that he's pursued.
Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com.
The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. The Wildlife is also brought to you in part by Burlington Telecom, providing Burlington with access to the world. Internet, television, telephone, burlingtontelecom.com, Burlington's fiber optic network. Now, here's a public service announcement from Wildlife Friendly. Certified Wildlife Friendly is a global community whose mission is to protect wildlife in wild places while supporting the enterprises of the people who coexist with wildlife and who are working to protect their habitat. When you buy Wildlife Friendly, you are helping to save the most endangered wildlife in the world while helping some of the poorest communities in the most magnificent places left on Earth. Certified Wildlife Friendly products and services support the triple bottom line of people, planet, and profit. More information is available at www.wildlifefriendly.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.